Okay, great. Can you just state your name?
Yeah, my name is Marcia Naus.
Okay. And just give us your general background. How did you come to work at Mozilla, and what do you do at Mozilla now?
Okay, basically, I started with Mozilla back in the Netscape days. I started working with Mozilla.org shortly after AOL acquired Netscape, which I believe was in like the 99-2000 timeframe. I started working at Netscape, and then in one capacity in HR shortly after I moved to working with Mitchell. As part of my shared responsibility, I worked for Mozilla.org and Sustaining Engineering, who sustained the communicator legacy code. So I supported them administratively. That's basically what I did for Mozilla. I did a lot of, I guess what you kind of call glue activities, where we have a process whereby people get access to our CVS repository. So I was the gatekeeper for all the CVS forms and handle all the bugs that were related to CVS requests, that kind of thing. Right now at Mozilla, I do quality assurance, and I run both our domestic online store as well as our international store, where we sell all of our Mozilla gear.
Okay. Let's see.
And are you working generally alone in small groups, in large groups? How do you sort of relate to other people working on the project?
Well, it's a rather interesting project. I'm in my capacity as a QA person. We basically relate with the community quite a bit because we have a very small internal QA organization. All along, as the project has gone from its very inception, the community has been a very important part of our project. So I work most closely with the other members of the QA team, which is very small. We only have a handful of people, and pretty closely with the community members on an ongoing basis to help us test all the products.
And sort of who's in charge of the QA group? I mean, and who decides who's in charge?
Well, it's interesting. We just recently have a QA director. Before that, it was a much more loose kind of thing where there wasn't really anybody in charge. Being an open source project, it's like I don't like to think of it in terms of people in charge. I like to think of it as a collaboration. I think that an open source project like what we develop is very much like, I feel, I studied film at USC, and I feel like film, that a lot of times you can't give too much to the director, because film is a collaboration where all the parts, I mean, the cinematographer, the person that writes, the person that directs, it's all like, synchronicity. And I feel the same way about our project, is that's how it has to be. We take a lot of input from the community, and we kind of like provide guidance, but we like to take in a lot of what the community gives us. That's how I look at it.
But so then, how then are most of the decisions made? If a decision needs to be made on a certain thing, how are, or another way to put it, how are conflicts resolved between those players?
I think it's changed a little bit. As we're becoming more structured, more structure is coming to the project. I think that may change a little bit. And also our product has changed. Before it was the Mozilla application suite. Now we have separate Firefox and Thunderbird, so we have different communities and different players. I think we take in a lot of input from the community and from all the different people within the organization, and that's how we work to resolve conflicts. A lot of discussion and talking, and maybe it's through email threads, maybe it's with the community. It's hard because our people are all over the world. Mm-hmm. So you can't really, always get on a conference call and resolve something. A lot of it has to be done, electronically.
Yeah, that was actually my next question, is how generally do you communicate with people?
Well, we do it through news groups, a lot of news group postings. We have a quality assurance blog where we put out blogs communicating what we want from the community as far as participation and a kind of, day in the life of QA, what we're kind of doing on this end from like an infrastructure perspective. So most of our communication is all just out there. Oh, blogs are huge. I mean, everybody in our Mozilla organization has a blog. Probably some of them are followed more closely than others, like Mitchell and Asa. But people look to the blogs for what's going on in the project.
Mm-hmm. So you think that's working best right now?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the blogs are... and I remember when I first started at Mozilla, blogs were... When somebody said to me, blog, I didn't even know what it was. And then that was when blogs weren't really hip as they mm-hmm. are today. Now it's such a huge... when the social anthropologists look back, they're going to say, wow, that really revolutionized the way people communicate and how people participate in different projects all the way to, democracy.
Do you see any drawbacks to sort of communicating electronically rather than being able to work in kind of in close quarters with people?
There are some drawbacks. I myself, having worked at Netscape, like the idea that we were all in a building and I could go track people down if I had a question. Our organization, we have a mix of people that work in the office and a mix of remote people, and then factor in the community who are located all over the place. It's a different kind of communication. We rely a lot on IRC, the IRC channels, and some people find that a little bit impersonal, and just like in instant message sessions, you can sometimes misinterpret what people say. But I think that some of us have gotten so good at the culture of Mozilla and dealing with people on IRC that we're very good at it, whereas a newbie might not be as good at it. So I think that we operate very well in the you know digital electronic space just because of that's how it's always kind of been.
Do you have any examples of how there have been miscommunications or any stories about?
I can't recall any specific stories, but I know for myself personally, I've had miscommunications and misunderstandings of people in instant message communications where they've you know tried to convey something I haven't gotten. And I know there's been a couple of instances where one of my coworkers has said, you know, please get on the phone and talk to me. I don't understand what you're saying in IRC. So there are some people that can't negotiate that space as well as others. But I think in general, being such a developer-centric community, all those people came to us kind of from IRC. Like, I don't know if you know Stuart Parmenter, nicknamed Pav, who's in the documentary Code Rush. He was, like, known on IRC as Pav, and kind of, like, he formulated his persona through IRC and then kind of came to us that way. And people had no idea that he was only a kid. They thought he was an adult. Here's a kid that was hacking that was, I don't know how old he was, maybe 12, 13 years old. So that's how he was just on IRC, and he was hacking away at Mozilla, and now he still works with us.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Actually, that sort of brings up another question. Working sort of more on the business side, the administrative side of business, if we want to call it that, do you see any differences in culture between the people who are sort of, you know, developers, engineers, versus people who are the smaller group of people who are working on the administrative end of things?
You mean you're talking about our organization as it exists now?
Either, and both. And how has that changed?
Yeah, I mean, it really has. I mean, our project, when I first started, Mozilla.org, was we had like a weekly staff meeting. It was a small group of people. It was just a very different... we weren't as well known, but we had a core group of developers that always worked with us. And we harvested, Netscape actually harvested people out of the Mozilla community into the Netscape project. That's how we built our engineering base. A good hacker would be identified, we'd identify him and he'd come into the project. Netscape would hire him. That's kind of how we built up our project. And things changed over time, but the core group of people who were with Mozilla.org are still with the project. If you look at it now, it was people like Mitchell, like Frank Hecker, Dan Mosdale, Gervase Markham, many of the people that sat with me in those meetings years ago, back to 99, are still with the project, which I think is an interesting thing, that people have had a passion for Mozilla that's carried through all these years. But it's a much different project than it was. The Firefox just exploded. I mean, Mozilla was like kind of a little bit under the radar. People were like using it and hacking on it, but it wasn't this big, there wasn't this big explosion, this big adoption. This has been kind of an interesting thing for us to deal with, because for me, the scale that I never realized that we were going to, have millions of users worldwide, and it was going to explode like it did. If somebody had asked me that back in 99, I never would have believed, I'd be sitting here and we'd be Mozilla Corporation, and it was pretty unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Well, why do you think that Mozilla Firefox has been able to attract so many users?
Well, I think that, when the core group of people, so the Mozilla application suite was a much larger animal. I mean, it had the mail client in it, it had the browser, had a chat client, and had Composer, the HTML editor. So I think that when the people that were working at Netscape, they were kind of unhappy with the way things were going. Remember that we were always under Netscape's, Mozilla was built as a base of Netscape, but then they would throw all this stuff on top of it that a lot of people didn't like. You know, we didn't get to make a lot of decisions about the UI at the end of the day, and there was a lot of things that Netscape wanted to add on top of it. But I always liked just the core base. I used to just run Mozilla. I used the Mozilla Mail, and I used the Mozilla browser. So at some point, I think that there was some level of unhappiness with the developers at Netscape with how things were going. They sat down and said, you know, if we could make a browser that just, you know, we could make it, you know, how would we do it? And so David Hyatt and Asa Dotzler, who works with us here, Blake Ross, and a few other individuals just sat down and thought of the things that are important to users without doing like a big usability study and all of that, and they came up with Firefox. And then at some point, you know, the Thunderbird kind of, I guess, followed after that as a separate email client. But I think it was simplifying things, making the browser faster, not so bloated. That, you know, the Mozilla Application Suite is a huge download. Firefox is a much, you know, more condensed package to download. But I think that really the usability, when you look at Firefox compared to Mozilla, that's what people really liked.
That actually raises another question that we have, is that that during the early development of Firefox, the CVS was restricted to a sort of small group. And how was that decision made? Why was it made? How did that group get together?
The group of people, like you're talking about, like David Hyatt and the group. I don't know. I think that I wasn't really, when I was at Netscape, I was aware that there was like something going on, but I wasn't really, like, Ace is a very good person to ask about that particular question because he can speak more to, you know, how that, like, that alliance kind of formulated, and I'm not really sure, but it was definitely people who had had some level of dissatisfaction with the way that the browser was currently and thinking that they could hack. And there was also a story I was told that some external person that was hired made some comment about Gecko, and it got people incited to a level that, hey, you know, Gecko, you know, and Zool are the way of the future, that, you know, we'll show you kind of thing. So I think Chris Hoffman mentioned to me a story once that that speaks to some external influence also making somebody mad enough to say that we could, you know, we could do better. And they sat down and did, and in their spare time they hacked, and you know, David Hyatt's a very, you know, he's a very experienced engineer, and he's like a level of like a chief architect now. He works at Apple, and I think he was instrumental in Safari as well.
Mm-hmm. What do you think sets Mozilla off from Firefox in particular, off from other open source projects? What's different about Mozilla, the culture that has made it so widely successful?
I don't know. I think that what I brought up about people having a passion for it, and you know, we've been able to keep true to like our hacker, kind of like our hacker mentality. To the many of the same people, and I shouldn't only say the same people that I sat with in those Mozilla.org staff meetings, but many of the developers are still working with projects. Something about you know, the project as a whole that attracts people and people like, and the sustainability that we've been able to get from a lot of the engineering team, some of the same players, like, you know, I just can't even believe the number of people that have, you know, kind of still hung around. And there's something that's attractive about, and I think to a certain degree too, we liked kind of always being the underdog. I liked it better when we were flying under the radar than being so much, you know, like, you know, the feature attraction, because it adds a certain level of pressure, you know, and expectation. Before, we didn't have the expectations because we were always kind of like, oh, you know, Mozilla's, you know, people are using it, and now with the market share so high and everybody talking numbers and thinking we're trying to, you know, to slay Microsoft, you know, David and Goliath kind of comparisons, it puts us in a much different, you know, situation than we were. But I think the overall thing is that people are just, they're just attracted to, I think when we made the switch to Gecko to people, that was attractive to people, and Zool is still. There's a lot of potential for, you know, still being creative in the browser space, I think, and also in the email client space. And people like building off that, almost like building up Mozilla as a platform.
How would you compare Mozilla's vision back in 1998 to today's reality?
Mozilla's vision? Well, again, it was so much less formal then. Mitchell would probably have some good answers here. Maybe, you know, I joined and I wasn't as entrenched in the project as she was. So like her idea of a division and my idea of a vision wouldn't necessarily mesh. But it was a lot less, formal. But I think that I'm not really sure we were concerned with, making a good product, but there wasn't the visibility of Firefox has brought like a great more deal of pressure, I feel. Mm-hmm. And maybe others don't really feel it, but now like when we're out there, there's expectations and, with Microsoft trying to do Internet Explorer, of course they're gonna match our feature pairing, everything. We didn't have those worries and those concerns back in the early days. So I think our vision was simple, and I think that what was articulated is kind of like a mission statement is, keeping the internet open and free and giving people choice and an alternative. That's kind of more what Mozilla was about. It's like if somebody wanted to use a different browser other than IE, then we were offering them that chance. Mm-hmm. So that's I think that to me has always kind of been the vision, giving people choice, keeping the internet open and free and just a free product that everybody in the community can contribute to.
With the popularity of Firefox, then, what kind of new expectations do you feel in your job? What are the new challenges that?
Yeah, we have a lot of new challenges. I think that right now we're in the early days of Mozilla, we only had the Mozilla application suite and of course Netscape that was built off of it. Now we have more that we're maintaining. We've got a 1X branch that we're still maintaining. We've got the 1.5 branch that we're doing releases on, as well as developing Firefox 2 and Firefox 3. So we have to continue to innovate in the browser space, but at the same time maintain many more releases than we ever did in the other days with a much smaller subset of people. From a QA perspective, in its Netscape heyday, client product development had over 250 people. That was engineering, marketing, quality assurance. Say there was maybe 50 QA people, and each QA person at Netscape had one responsibility for one area of the browser. Say one person did the installer, one person did bookmarks. Today, our QA, we only have like a handful of people covering that more of a wider swath because we don't have just one product. We have multiple products. And we actually are still maintaining the Mozilla Application Suite. I think the 1.7.13 will be the last release. So we have Mozilla Application Suite, Firefox, and Thunderbird 1X branches, and Firefox and Thunderbird 1.5, and then developing to the future 2.0 and 3.0 for both products. So that's a pretty full plate.
Yeah.
Do you see that I guess, how are things different today than you would have expected them to be? Like, look, if you had thought forward from 1998, 1999, and where did you think things would be in 2006? Or can you even remember?
I think it surprised me a little that we ended up getting so much visibility. I wasn't as intimately involved in what was going on with the people who were developing Firefox. But I guess, I even after we developed Firefox and, I started working with the Mozilla Foundation. They brought me in. I was actually working at Google and Mozilla Foundation. Chris Hoffman asked me to come help out with 1.0, and even with 1.0, it still astonishes me that the numbers that we were able to get. I'm not so sure I even thought that we'd just keep growing. It seemed like almost exponentially, because just when I go back to the simple Mozilla.org roots, it's just the explosion is just exceeded what I would have expected. I thought maybe the project would. I always thought the project would continue and have sustainability because the same thing. There was always people interested. But now that the visibility has gotten higher, there's even more interest.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any dangers in the kind of visibility that you've achieved? Are there any threats as well as promises that come?
Well, I think that as you get more visible, then you're. I think that unfortunately, more people have come out of the woodwork from a security standpoint and tried to you exploit the browser and email client in different ways. I think we're seeing more of that probably than we did in the early days. Because as your visibility increases, I guess there's always people that want to see you fail for some reason. We don't know exactly who these people are, but It ends up you end up spending some degree of time having to worry about security vulnerabilities and that kind of thing. And then when you're more visible, people expect you to react to them more quickly and resolve them, which we do. And I think Mozilla has always done a very good job at versus Microsoft, who may take a month to respond to things. We respond to things very quickly but I definitely think that there's been more of that kind of thing going on as Firefox and Thunderbird have become more popular.
How about in terms of the development, the culture of developers and the Mozilla community? Has the success of the project, Firefox, but the other projects, changed that culture at all?
I think that it may have changed a little. I don't think a lot. I still think we're having to negotiate different kinds of things than we may have had to before. Like I said, there was a difference. We didn't have such a formalized marketing plans and things back in the early days that I think everything's become a bit more formal now that we've gotten market share and that we're larger and we've gotten more visibility. As far as the developer community, again, I don't really see huge differences except that we're able to now hire more people to work, paid than we did in the early days of, the foundation and Mozilla.org. In the early days was much more, very little. I mean, Netscape was paying the developers, but fewer paid developers and more community people. And now we have people who can be paid to just work on, Firefox.
Mm-hmm. What's the sort of relationship between the people who kind of work here and are paid to work on this, either here or at Google or people who are kind of paid to do this, and people who volunteer?
I think there's good working relationships. We have a lot of engineers in the community that work with our developers here, have good relationships. There's a lot of people that like to hack on Mozilla that can't do it full time, but when they have time, like on the weekends, you'll see a lot of activity. You can't believe the number of bugs that get filed in Bugzilla on a weekend, because that's when people who don't work 9 to 5 during the week or whatever have time to, have their little niches. I know Scott McGregor, who works on Thunderbird, we often reward a lot of people in the community. There's some professor at either MIT or Harvard that has some little niche area in Thunderbird that he likes to contribute to, and he does that in his spare time. And he's not paid for it, but he just feels that this particular area of Thunderbird is interesting enough for him to devote time to work on in kind of his spare time. And we see a lot of that kind of thing.
Why do you think people volunteer?
I think you have to look at it as the overarching thing is why do people just volunteer in general? I think that it's something they like to do in their spare time, something that they have a passion for, something that interests them. I think engineering and coding is challenging for people. ASA's talked about people who got interested in Firefox because one woman broke up with her boyfriend and it was a way, and she got involved in either triaging bugs or doing just something to take her mind off her problems kind of thing. So we have people come to the project for all different reasons, but I think it's in general people just enjoy what they're doing. I think from a QA perspective, the people that come on an ongoing basis like the challenge of finding defects, kind of things that I like to do, try to break the product, crash it. There's lots of things in QA. You have space to be creative, even in QA, to do different things to challenge you. Basically, it's challenging.
The Spread Firefox website says that Spread Firefox was founded on the same principles of community involvement that drive the development and testing of Firefox. How do you see open source principles interacting with marketing? Does the marketing of an open source product differ from the marketing of a commercial product?
It may a little. Again, this sounds like a great question for Asa. That's more of his area. But I guess going back to just thinking about how big a thing the New York Times ad was and that whole effort and people out in the community willing to contribute money to get Firefox exposure in the New York Times, and then there was some degree of criticism levied against that of whether that was even a good use of expenditure funds. Shouldn't we have been putting the money back into the project? What if we had taken all the money that we put into the ad, and put it back into the project, invested it? Or was it more important to put the word out there and do marketing, as you say, for an open source project? So I think that there's some degree of, I'm not so sure Firefox needed some degree of marketing, but it also is one of those things that spread a lot by word of mouth, I think, and by people, by referrals. I think there was certainly Spread Firefox helped a lot, and those kind of like community efforts at that level versus I'm more in favor of doing that kind of thing than taking out big ads, and they're even talking about doing like television ads for Firefox, and I'm not so sure that I really like that. I kind of like a different approach to marketing, more getting out to the level of our users, the mom and pop kind of thing, rather than maybe like doing a spiffy spot that's going to be like a Super Bowl commercial or something. I don't think we're going to do that, but something like that.
Why not? Is it just because of the money that would be involved in?
Well, we're having this Firefox Flicks contest now. I'm looking at some of the submissions that come in, and what has really struck me about all the entries so far is that people are not creative. What they are doing is they're taking existing television ads that are out there and just reworking Firefox into them instead of coming up with messaging that to me would be, kind of like, okay, here's the message you want to get out for Firefox, like that's more secure or whatever, building something around that. Instead, I see people taking existing marketing campaigns that other people have done, plugging Firefox in. So even our community in trying to like create things so far, we haven't gotten all the entries in, but what I've seen so far has not really wowed me as far as people are using like the Vonage, there's like a music that goes along with that ad or something. I'm just waiting for somebody to come up with a really cool, ad that doesn't like use messaging from some other company. That I don't really know if I'm describing it that well, but. And I probably will get one. I just haven't seen it yet. Mm-hmm. But I like the principle of having the community actually try to develop, ads and messaging for us, I think is pretty cool.
You mentioned that you work on the online store.
Yes.
And who are the people who are buying Firefox gear, and why do you think people want to wear a Firefox T-shirt?
Very interesting question. I think there are a couple things there. So historically, the Mozilla engineering demographics or people who follow the project have always liked T-shirts. And we did, for our various releases, we always did do T-shirts. The Mozilla Hack T-shirt still stands as like one of the most popular T-shirts of all time that people really love. So I think our kind of culture always liked T-shirts. And then when John Hicks designed the Firefox logo, for some reason people really liked the logo. And I think that kind of took off. I think if we had a bad logo for both Firefox and Flickr, but I'm not so sure we would sell T-shirts. But our store, our bread and butter of our store continues to be T-shirts and CDs. A lot of people buy the Firefox and Thunderbird CD set. And for the reason may be that they want to just have it. So if their computer crashes, I don't know why people buy it and don't download it, except maybe they have dial-up and it's too slow. But we sell a lot of apparel and we sell CDs. And in the beginning time of the store, we had a guidebook that went to the CD, and I suspect that in like around the 1.0 days when Firefox was newer, we had a lot of new adopters, and they wanted a little guidebook to learn how to use the browser. And we were getting like the mom and pop demographic who was coming to the store, and they really didn't know how to use a browser, somebody's grandmother or something like that. So it's been kind of interesting to see the store, but I've been working with the store since the beginning, and I can tell you that we still continue to do very well with the T-shirts. The T-shirts are the best sellers.
What do you think it is about the logos that...
I've seen comments in news groups and postings and things that people really like the logo. And Firefox is kind of like a cool like aura to it or something that people like. And I'm just astonished at the number of T-shirts that we sell. I've seen people all over the place. I've been in airports, at JFK airport, and seen people with Firefox T-shirts. It's become more recognizable over time. Before, like the Mozilla, if somebody saw a Mozilla shirt, it would be like the Mozilla community would just recognize it. But now with Firefox, I think we're getting more mainstream recognition of our logos. And we're getting people who want our logos so bad that they're going and creating their own merchandise, even though we're trademark and copyright and everything, they're trying to sell Firefox shirts. So it's very interesting.
Have you ever contributed as a volunteer or an employee to any non-Mozilla open source project at all?
I don't believe so. No, I've done some volunteer work and contributed to other projects, but not specifically an open source project.
And how would you define, just in general, a successful open source project? What elements or practices, work practices or structural elements, do you see as necessary for developing a successful open source project?
I think the first piece that you need that's very important is you need to have, the community has to have a voice. It has to be, there has to be some kind of structure to the project, but it's important that all of the contributors have a say. And I think we have a lot of ways in the project that people do that. We have a mechanism in Bugzilla where people can vote for bugs. If there's a bug that's bothering you or a feature that you want, a request for enhancement, you can actually vote on it. And people look at that, and if there's enough demand, then we may decide to implement it. Other successful or other pieces I think you need is you need people who are passionate, and I think we've proven over and over again that we have that. We have people that are passionate, they keep coming back. But the voice and the participation of the community and the participation of a wide group of people from all different parts of the world, coming from all different, like, not everybody in our project is an engineer either. Like I said, we have professors, we just have so many different pieces, and I think that's all these pieces interacting, but at the end of the day, the Firefox puzzle they make is just exquisite. And I think that that's because we have all of this participation. It's not just like the Mozilla Corporation sits around, makes a bunch of decisions about what the browser is going to be, and then throws it out there. I think it's the community. We take in an awful lot of feedback from the community about our processes, about our structure. We're very open about how we operate, and we want the community, like for the QA processes and test days and things we do, we love to get feedback. That's why we put things out in the blog, let people communicate to us what they expect from us or what they want or what they'd like to do, what they'd like to see. Here's the tools that we're using. What tools do you think we're going to need to use? We just talked about in a meeting a few minutes ago about a test harness that we're going to actually kind of hack together and then put out to the community for feedback and let them actually hack on it. We want the community to participate in this project completely, and that's why I think we're going to have success.
How does the community deal with dissent? If there are arguments within the community and that don't seem to be resolved, what happens with dissenters? Do people?
Well, we've had as the project has gone along, we've had people who've been problematic. We've had people who have just been troublesome to the point where we've had people who didn't follow the rules. We have a specific set of rules that allow you to get access to to be able to get CVS access and to be able to comment in bugs and act in a responsible manner. We've had people come in Bugzilla, start smearing, calling people out, and we have people that go in and say, hey, if you don't stop this, we're going to either take away your privileges or do something. I mean, it has to be something fairly drastic. But I think we have a good mechanism for dealing with people who are the problematic ones that, again, I think that the Mozilla structure, and there's also respected people in the community that people look to for guidance. Like if somebody like Mike Shaver comes in a bug and says, hey, stop this, tomfoolery, this is what has to happen. And there's enough people in the Mozilla project that are respected that people will just say, okay, I'll listen to that person. He or she's reasonable.
So kind of the enforcement mechanism is a kind of informal one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I said there will be cases where we would take somebody's privileges away, but it'd have to be a pretty heinous offense where somebody does something. But in general, we allow a lot of latitude in our Bugzilla product. We allow community members to nominate bugs for releases. We allow a lot of community participation in what we do.
Who ultimately makes the decisions if somebody gets kicked out?
I think it depends on what it is. It might be, if it was an engineer doing something or somebody coming. If somebody's disrupting the project, then I think you really have to look to do some kind of enforcement. And we have had, I can't remember. I mean, in the time that I've been overseeing CVS accounts, I can't even remember. I can count on like one hand the number of times we've actually ever had to revoke somebody's access where they were doing something that they weren't supposed to. We trust people to do the right thing. If we give them access to our repository, we can't really give them specific access to one area, so they get access to the whole thing, but I trust them that they're only going to check into the area that they have expertise in. And as I said, we haven't had a big problem with enforcement. We've had some troublesome people come along, and as we've got more visibility, I see it sometimes in blogs where people, start to become disruptive, and in Ace's blog particularly, I've seen it, where people they want to come in and be a pain in the neck for whatever reason. It could be just people that are, anti-Firefox or pro-Microsoft or whatever. But I think we've always kind of had like an informal process.
Do you know what happens? I mean, you said that there aren't many of them. Do you know what happens to those people after they leave the community?
I don't know. Some people have tried to come back. and do different things. I remember there was one person that was, we gave him access to change documentation, and he went crazy and started changing everything. And, you know, we can't have that because documentation is very important. So sometimes if you give somebody privileges to our doctor repository, they can go in and start changing things. And, you know, you're always supposed to, like, make it, you know, change comment. And, I, you know, this person I don't think was following the policy. And I think that, you know, he just eventually kind of fell off the radar. But you do still have to have some kind of, like, you know, enforcement and structure, because like I said, you can't have people coming in just disrupting everything, or you're never going to be able to move forward. And Bugzilla has grown big enough now with a number of bugs, and since it's our main place that we kind of transact business, that there has to be some kind of, like, you know, checks and balances of things that go on. So when people start to act inappropriately, I think, you know, usually someone in, sometimes it's somebody in the community that steps up and says, you know, hey, you're being silly. Kind of thing, but we don't really have a huge problem with that in our project that I see.
Mm-hmm. And I'm asking this because one of the big questions I think here is what constitutes membership in the community and how you become a member and how you stay a member and how you participate as a member of the community. And so one of the interesting things to talk about is how you stop being a member of the community, mm-hmm. to see kind of the opposite. We can move on. Let's see. Do you consider open source software projects, or Mozilla in particular, as public service?
I think you can look at it in a way. I mean, I think we're providing a public service in the sense that we're providing an alternative to people that's free. People don't have to pay for our product, right? There's no charge for it. You download it. You know, if you need to get it from disk, you'd have to pay for the disk because we have to produce a disk and it costs money. I'd love to be able to give disk away for free, but we can't. But in the sense that, I definitely think we're providing a public service. It's something that people, I mean, the internet has become such a part of people's lives, and it's going to continue to in the future, and we're providing a way for people to, you know, negotiate that internet space in a safe and secure way, and we're doing things to innovate to make their life easier, things like RSS feeds, some of these new features that are coming out that, again, are ways for people to, like, just, like, track information a lot easier. I mean, I think the internet is becoming so overwhelming in all these different pieces. You have to have ways to be able to track information easier. And when tab browsing came out, people thought that was great because then you didn't have to have all these browser windows open. But with RSS feeds, I can be watching as things are happening. I can be extracting and pulling down information instead of going to hunt for everything. And that's where I think RSS is the next big thing. But I think that the way that the browser was made, we were definitely helping people. So we're helping the public.
And why do this over something that you might be able to make more money doing?
Some of us that came to the Mozilla Foundation when we weren't making a lot of money. I had a job offer from Google that I walked away from. We do it because we love it, because it's challenging. We think we're doing something, you know, to help people. I think at the end of the day, that's a good feeling. It's different. From people who might be working for, like, I often joke with my physical therapist about, you know, at the end of the day, she's helping people too because she's helping free people from pain. But we're providing an alternative. We're making, I think, a pretty creative product. And I think in addition to all the emphasis on Firefox, I really like to talk about Thunderbird because I think Thunderbird is a great email product that also has a lot of great features that makes it really easy to be able to organize your mail, read your mail, do all the things you need to operate on your mail really efficiently. But Thunderbird doesn't get all the, you know, the attention and doesn't get the huge download numbers that Firefox but it's a great product. So I like, and I actually like working on Thunderbird. I work pretty closely with the developer and I enjoy doing it. There are some other products like Minimo or a little mobile browser. When I first started working at Mozilla, I loved testing that. I helped Doug Turner, who's the lead developer on that. We have a lot of our technology can be used in a lot of different places. We just have to decide where we want to invest, you know, some of that technology. Like, do we want to invest in the mobile space and have people walking around with Gecko-enabled web phones? You know, is that something that Mozilla wants to do? Because there's a lot of potential. I mean, we've already proven that we can take our footprint, shrink it, and it can run. It's just how much further do you want to take it? And what kind of devices in the future you know, are going to be more powerful and more engaged to be able to make browsing, you know, browsing on a big computer screen and browsing on a small mobile device are very different. So you have to make the experience good. And some of the page layouts today are so, they render so crazy that, you know, to compress that into a small footprint, still be able to operate in it. So I think that's the challenge. And Doug has done some great things with making even tab browsing in the mobile, the little mobile Minimo.
How does the organization, the community, sort of decide to follow that path? To like, when is the decision made to say we're going to put some resources into this?
Well, I think that this, it's kind of an ongoing thing. I think this is one of the things now that we've become, the foundation of the corporation is, I think we need to find out what our path is going to be. I think there's discussion amongst the different players in the organization as to, you know, where do we want to be? You know, what do we want to invest in? I think with Thunderbird, Firefox is right now the premier thing. Thunderbird and Minimo and some of the other things. Even Bugzilla is one of our products that's used by thousands of organizations. You know, how much do we want to invest in that project? It's something that the organization has to decide, I think, and you know, in concert with the community. But I think at the end of the day that, you know, we have to be able to portion resources to some of these projects to make them move forward. Like Thunderbird needs to have a calendar client to really get widespread adoption. That's the piece that it's missing to take it to the next level. But in order to do that, we need development help. And if you can't get it from the community, then maybe you have to think about hiring internal resources. The same thing with Minimo. I think that their Minimo kind of is a small project that has promise, but it doesn't have enough developers working on it right now to get it to the next level. So I think as an organization, we have to really sit down and figure out, you know, what are the things that we want to invest in? Where do we want to be? What is Firefox 2.0 and 3.0? What's the next big thing on the web? That's what, whoever figures that out is going to be the person that's left standing. Because at the end of the day, if you think about it, if Microsoft comes out with feature parity with us and has, you know, improved some of their security concerns, then people will be standing back and saying, Wi-Fi, you know, why do I want to use Firefox? There has to be, continue to be innovation. And that's really the challenge. And I hope that some of that innovation comes from the community. Like we're talking about giving out grants to people, you know, to develop different tools and different, you know, pieces that can plug into our technology. What about the fact that we have a great extension developer community? We have all these people out there developing cool extensions. We just finished an extension contest. And some of those extensions actually are good enough to actually plug in and make as part of the browser, I think. So I think that's the other thing that's really attractive about Firefox is the customizability. I really like the fact that when the developers were sitting down trying to figure that out, that we have an extension of theme mechanism that allows you to make the browser whatever you want it to be. So if I want to have my weather, I just put Forecast Fox right down in my status bar. If I want to block ads, I install AdBlock. I mean, there isn't another browser that has that kind of customizability, and that kind of sets us apart from some of the other players out there.
Is there a kind of person who you would characterize as an open source person, either a developer or a user? Is there a set of characteristics that you point to that makes someone want to be part of this community?
I think characteristics would be, as I said, I think the person has passion. I think the person is interesting in innovation and moving the product forward, looking for a challenge. Those are probably the three things. But I think, again, passion, because it has to be something that you want to do. You know, you work, you know, 40 plus hours a week, and then in your spare time you want to hack on Mozilla because you have, you know, you think it has promise.
Great. Just sort of the last question. What if anything, do you think, you know, the popularity of Firefox in particular is going to do for the open source movement as a whole? And what do you think the future of open source looks like?
I think the future of open source is pretty bright. I think that this is the great thing that we've been able to show people is that open source works. We've been able to make a success of open source as a sustained project over time. We've been able to keep our product free, which I think is a big thing too. We're not charging people. I mean, there are some open source projects that have to still charge for their product. So I think that's one real big accomplishment is we've had the sustainability. We're still here. We're able to offer a free product to people that people can use. That I think is really great. And there's a lot of promise for the future. I think that, you know, I think that it's, well, look, the great example of how, what an effect we've had, I think, is that Songbird open source iTunes. Now, I wonder if that would ever have come about if it wasn't for us. I think that we definitely had some, played some part in that. And one of the guys that I wanted to hire went to work for them. So, are also the fact that we do offer open source, look at Flock. Flock wants to do something with our browser. They want to take our browser and turn it into some, you know, social, some, I'm not really sure what they want to do, but anyway, our browser is, people are taking our browser, embracing it for a variety of other uses, or, you know, which I think is really cool. So I definitely think that the explosion of Firefox had a larger effect, a larger ripple on the open source, you know, and beyond the open source. I mean, people want to, you know, people also want to take Firefox and probably make money off it too. But I think that Songbird is probably the best example of something that might not have come around if it wasn't for Firefox.
Great. Well, that's all we've got.
Okay.
Thanks.
Hope it was. You're going to talk to Amy.